Welcome to the Mountain Grapevine program on WART Community Radio for Madison County, North Carolina. My name is Chuck Blethyn, your host for today's program. The Mountain Grapevine reports on all things grape and wine in the mountains of western North Carolina, and sometimes elsewhere. My programs will have interviews with movers and shakers in the viticulture and wine industries, as well as some educational sessions on wine etiquette, wine evaluation, and special value-added products that can be made from grapes. On today's program, we're going to be interviewing Jay Raffaldini. He's the winemaker and owner of Raffaldini Vineyards and Winery in Rhonda, North Carolina. Jay has brought to the mountains of North Carolina some very interesting winemaking techniques that I'm sure you'll be interested to hear about. So, Jay, welcome to the program, and just tell us a little bit about where you came from and how you got interested in growing grapes and making wonderful wine.
Yeah. Thank you very much for the opportunity, Chuck. And my way of background is my family is born and raised in Italy, and I'm first-generation New Yorker. And I've been working in New York my whole life and living there. I work on Wall Street. And then by the time I was turning 40, I wanted to pursue something else in my life simultaneously with this. And obviously, wine was a natural, growing up Italian, wine is a key part of your daily life. Something you drink when you eat. So I was exposed to wine very early. I remember drinking wine at the table when I was 7 years old. So the idea that, you know, that I wanted to start a vineyard and make wine was always in my DNA. It just took till I was 40 to really surface. So because I worked in New York, I kind of ruled out the West Coast. It was very far. You travel back and forth, and there were a lot of vineyards there. So I focused on the East Coast. And at the time, it was really just three areas growing, you know, grapes and really being a major wine region in the year 2000. And that effectively was the Finger Lakes in New York, Long Island, and of course, Virginia. So as I did more and more research in New York about, you know, what I wanted to grow, it ruled out New York, meaning that I love big reds, and it's quite cold in the Finger Lakes. It's mostly ice wines and whites, and even Long Island, it was a little bit tricky to make the bigger reds, but Virginia kept popping up on my radar screen. So the more research I did in Virginia, the more I started to read about North Carolina. Because the climate in North Carolina and Virginia is very similar, and then I focused on North Carolina, and the more I focused on North Carolina, the more it became interesting to me. So I discovered through my research that, you know, before Prohibition, North Carolina made more wine than California. And so the history was here, and that attracted me to North Carolina.
Well, we certainly have a fantastic history in the wine business. I'm happy you made the choice, and I'm sure our listeners will too.
Thank you. And once I focused on North Carolina, then I needed to kind of define my style of wine. So the style of wine that I wanted to focus on is, of course, dry, because at times, you know, most of the wine we drink is dry. And so once I narrowed that down, then I started to source some properties. So I looked at 62 pieces of land I hired from California, who was in charge of the vineyards for Ravenswood. So he flew down from Napa, and we took the 62 pieces of land. And I finally chose one piece, which was 42 acres, and I bought that in the year 2001. And a very funny story. So I was actually signing the mortgage for that property on my 40th birthday. And as I was signing the mortgage for going out to my birthday party, and a song came on the radio by Dean Martin, and that was "Money Burns a Hole in My Pocket." And my wife caught the irony of that right away. Anyway, so that was the first. And then after that, I bought three other parcels, and over the remaining, 14 years, and that whole property is 132 acres. So when I started with the first 42, it was an abandoned farm. There was nothing going on there. It's been neglected for about 3 or 4 years. And I liked it because it was the proper altitude. It was 1,300 feet. And it faced the north and the east, which is the coolest part, and there was a constant breeze going out. So it was the right spot to grow grapes. The problem was I didn't know what grapes to grow, and that was the hard bit, because this is a new territory. Because remember, when I bought the land in 2001, there was only seven vineyards in the state. So it wasn't a body of knowledge that you could kind of rely on to see what's going to work and what's not going to work. So my initial planting of 42 acres was a hodgepodge of, you know, 2 acres of this, 2 acres of that, a little bit of French, Northern Italian. And I can tell you that within 4 years, I ripped out the entire vineyard.
Wow. Right?
And, you know, if you're doing, you know, 1,200 vines an acre, that's 50,000 vines I ripped out.
Right.
And then I did another replant of a little bit more central to Southern Italian, and that seemed to work. And why I did the rip out was we are relatively hot in North Carolina. It's not a Northern Italian climate. It's really not even a climate of Bordeaux or Burgundy. It's more of a climate of Spanish or Portuguese or Central to Southern Italian because it's hot here, right?
Yep.
So when I moved down in the geographical point, I had better success with the grapes. They were tasting like they were supposed to. I was getting the fruit. But unfortunately, it was quite an odyssey. I mean, I love Northern Italian grapes, but it's not possible for me. So once I went down south, I had great success. With a lot of varietals that no one ever heard of.
Well, certainly, that's at the time that you did this, that was really leading-edge thinking, because, as you know, we're still struggling to figure out what grows best all over the state, and most people don't have the fortitude and the financial backing and or the time to go through what you've gone through to get to the selection that you have.
Yeah, it's interesting because a vine can last 60 to 80 years or longer if you take care of it, right? So after kind of year 3 or 4, you kind of get a sense of the grapes getting, what the quality is going to be. Right? And the issue is, do you pull out and have a reboot, or do you kind of stick with it for the next 60, 70 years, right?
Right.
So short term is quite expensive, but longer term, it pays for itself, right?
Absolutely.
So in terms of varietals, you know, what we planted and what we have planted now, a lot of varietals are new to many people, including people that are really wine aficionados. So our first grape that we planted is Sangiovese, which is obviously the grape used to make Chianti in Tuscany. It does well, but it's a very finicky grape, so it requires a lot of time and attention. But when it's taken care of, it's just wonderful. And for those of those who don't know what Sangiovese tastes like, it really is a part of what we call like a Pinot Noir. Not a lot of fruit, but more elegance, more minerality, and lighter in color, right? And that's what the wine I grew up with. And the second red that we planted is called Montepulciano, which is where my mother is from, that part of Italy, and it makes much more darker, dense reds. Right. And then we planted another grape called Sagnantino, which is from the province of Umbria, east of Tuscany. It makes very big, muscular reds, dark and tannic. And then the one we just planted this year called Nero di Avola, which comes from Sicily. And this grape is interesting, was not certified to be planted in the United States, meaning that it hadn't gone through the disease testing cycle. But I wanted to plant this grape for 5 years. So we actually teamed up with a vineyard in California, an Italian vineyard, and petitioned the government to get this grape certified. And so this vineyard and ourselves were the first legal planting of this grape in the United States.
Was the certification required from the U.S. side or from the Italian side?
U.S. side. So all grapes have to go through a mandatory 3-year quarantine with UC Davis.
Really?
Kind of like, yeah, so they're the gatekeepers. And once it's certified disease-free, then they propagate it out to the other vineyards for future sale. But if it's not in their main repository, then it's not allowed. Right? I mean, you could sneak vines in, but then you bring in a host of problems, right? So we waited patiently, and we planted it. So of the 42 acres, I have 37 planted to dry red. So the only dry white that we have is a wonderful white wine called Vermentino. And Vermentino comes from the island of Sardinia. And I love this white wine because it's sort of in between a Chardonnay and a Viognier in weight, but it has this beautiful aromatics. So these are, you know, unique plantings. Many are not used to it. It's interesting. So when I started this, a lot of people said, oh, you're taking a big risk by planting grapes that people don't know. I said, no. The risk is when you plant something everyone knows. Because you're compared to it.
That's exactly right. For the radio listeners who are not familiar with some of these grape names, I'd like to point out that Jay is quite modest and humble with us. He has won, at least here in the Asheville area, we had the Asheville Wine and Food Festival competition of commercial wines this year, and his Vermentino, the one he was talking about, which he has, I guess, 8 acres or so from the white grape from Sardinia. The Vermentino won a double gold at the Asheville Wine and Food Festival competition this year, and his Montepulciano and the Sangiovese Reserva both won gold medals. So this man is making some very good wines there, people. So if you're interested in tasting some good wines, I suggest you head out to Raffaldini right away. So when you had picked these particular grapes, Jay, what else were you thinking about for future? Are you going to stick with these four or five, or are you going to add some additional ones later? What's your thinking on that?
We're really going to stick with these, with this lineup, because I think it's difficult, and this is more of a philosophical thing. I think it's difficult to do a lot of things well, right? So our goal every year is just to do incrementally better than the previous year in what we did, right? So in that way, by having these five varietals that really add up to about 8,000 cases, is that we're able to continuously supply people, and then they know what Vermentino tastes like, and they know what Montepulciano tastes like. So we're not going to really expand either the number of grapes or the acreage of grapes. What we're trying to do is just get better every year, right? And this is sort of a problem for our client base now, is that we sell every wine we make before the one-year inventory cycle turn, meaning, you know, when you make a wine, hopefully 1 year later, your next wine is ready, right? But we are unable to do that because our wines are selling out 6 to 9 months as opposed to 12 months. So,
gosh, what a problem to have, Jay.
well, we call it in New York a high-class problem, right?
Absolutely.
But the problem is, when people drive up to, to see us and the wine's gone, they still get a little bit irritated. So, but it's okay. I mean, and this is also why you rarely see our wines anywhere, because we don't distribute, because we want people to come to the vineyard so we can explain about the wine, how we made it, and why it's relevant, right? Otherwise, you're just a bottle on the shelf, and there's no connection with the story. So you have to really come up to the big villa that'll be made on a hill, to do your wine tasting.
Well, for the folks who haven't been there yet, Jay, I have to tell you, I made a visit out there last year with our group, as you may remember, the French Broad Vignerons, and we had a nice tour of your facility at that time. The grounds are absolutely astounding. Your tasting room is wonderful, and people who would just come there could sit very comfortably in peace and tranquility there in the shade of a tree and enjoy some good wine. It's a fabulous place to see. Reminds me a lot of some of the places I've been in Italy.
Thank you very much. And I think my personal bias, of course, is to dry wines, and I think the future of this area is in dry wines. Recently, I was in Virginia, and I up in the Charlottesville wine region, and also the Middleburg wine region, and I went to the top, 40, 50 producers, and they all had dry wines, right? So I think this, if we can, focus on this direction, I think the industry is going to be well served. So one of the questions I get is, I like the big West Coast style wines, and the East Coast wines tend to be more restrained. And the answer is simply because of the weather, right? So when grapes are getting ripe, they get to something called a level of sugars or bricks. When they get to 22, 23 bricks, the skins get very soft, and they're very vulnerable to disease pressure, right? And so you have to pick. And this is where they pick in Europe, because Europe has the same climatic challenges as us, right? But in California and Australia, there is no disease pressure because they're planted in pretty much a desert where it doesn't rain, right? And so they keep the grapes on the vines much longer. And the grapes get to 25, 26 sugars. So basically the grapes are dehydrating on the vine. And then they pick them and make these, very deep, dark, luscious reds and whites. Well, that's a style of wine that I like. So, I was puzzled by this. How can we make that fat style of wine in the East Coast? And I went to Italy, and I did some wine tasting, and I was at a wine region called the Veneto, where they make this beautiful wine called Amarone.
One of my favorites.
I love Amarone, right? And so I said, how is it possible to make this wine? Because you have bad weather like we do, random weather. And they showed me. So they showed me that when the grapes get to that 22, 23 sugar levels, they pick them, but they put them in these special drying rooms called frutallos. And they're these, you know, where they have racks, and they put grape clusters on the racks, and then close the door, turn on the fans, and dehumidifier. And then, you know, 30 days later, they open the door, and the grapes are at that 28, 29 sugar level. So they're dehydrating in a drying room. I was fascinated by this. I built immediately two large drying rooms, and last year we dried more fruit than anyone in the country, right? And the wines are just coming in beautiful and luxurious. So we can do those things in the East Coast to make that fatter style of wine. And so I've been making speeches about this drying process, which is called apasamento, which is Italian, it means to wither, right? And I told quite a few vineyards about this, and now four of their vineyards are drying in North Carolina, which is great, because if you think about what North Carolina has, a tremendous amount of unused facilities, it's a tobacco barn.
Absolutely. I just mentioned that the other day to the extension director here in Madison County, and he was totally unfamiliar with such a thing, so I got a little work to do here.
It's ultimate marriage of the past of North Carolina and the future of North Carolina in terms of using tobacco barns to dry grapes to make that luscious style of wine. I think this is the way we weave a story. We're able to get that wonderful dense style of reds and whites that people love.
Well, I'm super impressed with the approach that you've taken to do this, because I've seen that used in several areas in Italy over the past years that I've traveled there, and I have to say the wines that result from that process is absolutely astounding. And of course, Amarone is the most famous one that I'm aware of that I really, really like. So you're doing a wonderful thing there, Jay, with this approach to drying the grapes to get them up to the appropriate Brix to make the really big, bold reds that you love. At this point, I'd like to take a break, Jay. Hang on, we'll be right back.
The sponsor for today's program is Winnie's Winter Insect Repellent. Those of us who live in the mountains have special chores to do to get ready for winter. We make sure we have enough hay in the barn to feed our cows through the winter. We also make sure we have enough firewood to keep the old wood stove burning until spring. Most of us never stop to think about dealing with the winter insects we have here in the mountains. Most city folks know because they have read the scary newspaper headlines about our winter insect problem here in the mountains. Snow flies in the mountains, you may have read. Winnie Wiggler thought about it this past winter and invented a winter insect repellent. Her ingredient list includes cinnamon, cayenne, bloodroot juice, and possum grease, among other things. Winnie says it's very effective against snow flies, chill chiggers, ice mosquitoes, frost fleas, and frigid ticks. One application lasts for weeks. I tried it this past January, and she was right. I had no problems with any of those winter pests. Winnie's Winter Insect Repellent is another special product made in the good old U.S. of A. here in Madison County, North Carolina. You can buy Winnie's Winter Insect Repellent today at Zuma's Cafe in downtown Marshall for only $1.298. And now back to our regular program.
Welcome back, folks. We've been on the phone with Jay Raffaldini, winemaker and owner of Raffaldini Vineyards and Winery in Rhonda, North Carolina. Jay has been kind enough to share with us some of the interesting things he's done to bring us up to the point where he's been able to win 3 gold medals this last Nashville Wine and Food Festival commercial competition here in the mountains. So we know he's doing something right. Jay, tell us a little bit more about some of the things you did right, some of the things you could have done differently to bring us up to where you are right now.
Well, I think in terms of what we did right is we simply tried everything else and it didn't work out. And it was the only thing that was left. Right? So it wasn't that it was like a stroke of brilliance or anything, right?
Okay. Well, that's learning the hard way. Okay.
Exactly. But, you know, it's when you try something that doesn't work out, you build a base of knowledge. And your range of unknown unknowns is less and less, right? And so I think one of the breakthroughs that we had was we kept struggling following what we call research from the West Coast, particularly UC Davis. Because remember, most of the vineyards in the United States are out west, 95% are out west.
Oh, sure. California is most of them, absolutely.
And so most of the research is geared to those places.
Yeah.
So what I decided was we read as much as we could from all the research out there, and then what was most important is we put it in a big pile, and we burned it, and then we went in the compost pile because it's utterly useless for people in the East Coast because they get totally different climatic conditions. It doesn't rain. It's useless. So here's an example. They tell you to always leave leaves on your canopies to dapple the sunlight. Well, they say that because they don't have any clouds. So they get direct sunlight. Well, we have clouds. So what we do is we strip the leaves almost immediately from set of the grapes to get maximum exposure in there. And what this does is we ripen much faster, right? So we're able to get much less disease pressure. So these are examples of understanding that our growing conditions are so different from the West Coast, and the research hasn't kept up with our industry, so we have to try and experiment.
Jay, let me, just for the purpose of informing the listeners that may not understand mm-hmm. this, when you talk about stripping your leaves, you're talking about in front of or just slightly above the grapes themselves?
Exactly. So what's called something called is the fruiting zone where the grape, where the actual fruit is, we strip it completely,
okay.
Right? So there's maximum sun coming in and maximum wind.
Yep.
Because our issue is not lack of heat, as we know, it's lack of sun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And that was a big game changer for us.
Well, the problem that you had there in being unable to use a lot of the wonderful research that's available at UC Davis, we've got the same problem here in the mountain with what's been done with North Carolina State University and the folks out in Raleigh. You know, we're up in the mountains. It's different here. Soil's different. Climate's different. The way you grow, the kind of grapes that grow here is different. So I sympathize with you.
Exactly. So I think that's an important thing. And the other thing that I really didn't appreciate was the importance of clones. For example, let's assume that a listener wanted to plant Chardonnay. After this call, he's very excited. He wants to start a vineyard and plant Chardonnay. Well, there are two different types. There are 200 different types of clones for Chardonnay. So people think it's just one grape. No, you could have a Chardonnay from France, or you have a Chardonnay grape that might come in that does well in sandy soils. Others clay. So there's endless possibilities. And what we did is, just because you pick the right grape varietal, you have to pick the right clone. So we went through a lot of clonal research too. For example, Sangiovese has 20 clones. We planted all 20.
There's really 20 varieties of Sangiovese?
Yeah.
Seriously?
And we narrowed down to 5 that work and 2 that work exceptionally well. So, for example, one clone brings in color, another brings in tannin, another brings in aromas, another brings in mouthfeel. So by doing that, so one of the things that surprised me with a lot of people that grow grapes here is I'll ask them, what clone do you have planted? And they have no idea. So the clonal stuff is really important as well, and you only do that through trial and error.
Well, does that also take into account the rootstock?
It does as well, and that's the third part is the rootstock. And again, this is where the West Coast research is not particularly helpful, is that, they say, you want low vigor. Well, low vigor out there, it's impossible to have low vigor in the East Coast because we have water. An abundance of water, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to go to the lowest vigor possible all the time because we're battling excess nitrogen, excess water, whereas California's the opposite. So you can't, again, you have to pick the right grape, right clone, and right rootstock. Right? And you just do that through trial and error.
That's the way everybody here in the mountains learned to grow grapes here in the mountains. Trial and error. Jay, tell us a little bit about how you sell your wines. I think you said earlier they're only available at your winery. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, correct. And the reason is simply we just obviously we're suffering from excess demand situation.
Sure.
And I could increase the output of the vines, but the vines are still less than 10 years old.
Mm.
And so if you push them to give you a lot of quantity, the quality tends to decline.
Yeah.
So you can't push. And so what we do is we made a facility to come up to, you know, I built this beautiful Tuscan villa, and it's meant for people to come visit, to relax and stay a while and get to know us. So we have, I think, the largest wine club in the state. And what happens is the wine club people, they come and they connect with us, and then you bring other people up and the neighborhood wine club members, right? So it's, you know, so it's sort of a, people feel, you know, I think they have this impression that, oh, you're sort of like wasting money when you build a beautiful facility, you know, facility for people to stay when you can do distribution. Well, let me tell you, distribution is far more expensive than getting people to come on site. So we made a beautiful place in the mountains, and last year we had 35,000 people come through our property. We're only in a town of 400, so the whole town pretty much hates me, right?
But surely there's some other local businesses that are sort of piggybacking on your traffic.
Yeah, I think so, but they still are. Still have a dubious eye. What's this New York tie guy doing in my middle of nowhere? You know, these people come through.
Oh, Lordy. Well, tell folks how they could reach your website.
Yep. So our website is, it's raffaldini.com, and it's spelled R-A-F-F-A-L-D-I-N-I. That's www.raffaldini.com. And we're open pretty much 6 days a week. The only day we're closed is Tuesday, but people still come on Tuesday, and we still serve them, right? So the main point of why I started this is it's just not really to make wine. It's when you have a bottle of wine, whenever you ask someone, you know, about that special bottle of wine, they always tell you who they were, you know, where they were at and who they were with, right? Because wine is context, and I wanted to make a place where people could just slow down and make that connection, and that's really part of my wonderful journey.
Well, you know, we've done a lot of research here in North Carolina, as I'm sure you have seen in California and some other places, but unfortunately, at this point in time, the bulk of Americans who walk into a wine shop make their decision to buy a bottle of wine based upon the color of the bottle and the label, the design on the label, with no clue on what's inside. And yet, when I talk to the serious wine people in our French Broad Vineyards group, they have their favorite wines that they've found by going out to the wineries, and there's a story attached to every bottle. Whatever bottle you pick out of their cellar, there's a story that goes with it, and that's exactly what you're doing, is you're creating the story for the people to go with the wine that they share with their friends and family.
Exactly.
So it's a great, great idea. So I'm assuming that your website also has your phone number for making reservations or whatever. Do events?
Yeah, in fact, we have an online calendar, so we have events pretty much all the time. We have music and artist day. We have you know, food tastings and dinners, and it's really meant to really expand the idea that wine is really contextual, right? It's enjoy doing other things. So you go online to a website and you see a calendar, and we just want people to really get to know us and enjoy their time there.
Well, for all the radio listeners out there, we've been interviewing on the phone today Jay Raffaldini, who's the winemaker and owner of Raffaldini Vineyards and Winery in Rhonda, North Carolina. I strongly suggest that you take some time this next season and go out there and check out his wonderful villa and the tasting rooms there. If you've got some special events coming up you want to perform there, like weddings and so forth, I'm sure he'd be happy to accommodate you. And Jay, we want to thank you very much for sharing your time with us today on the radio show, and I'm looking forward to tasting what's coming out of your barrels next year.
Thank you very much for the time, and I think it's a wonderful time for the wine industry, particularly for all of our customers, to see what's going on. It's really an amazing story, and I think I'm just so thrilled to be part of it.
Well, we've been interviewing Jay Raffaldini, winemaker and owner of Raffaldini Vineyards and Winery in Rhonda, North Carolina. We'll call that a wrap for today's program.
This is the Mountain Grapevine on WART Community Radio from Madison County, North Carolina. If you have a friend whom you think might enjoy my program, tell them my Thursday programs will be rebroadcast on Sundays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is Chuck Blethyn signing off for today. Cheers!